First of all, once this is on, an announcement that tomorrow is Friday, and Friday night I am down to give the talk at Nollamara. So somebody else will have to answer the questions tomorrow night. I wonder who they will be. No, we have these wonderful nuns over there. There's no such thing as a free lunch, sisters. And you've had many free lunches. So tomorrow evening, the questions, I invite the sisters, the nuns, to please answer those questions. So any questions you put in the box for tomorrow will be to the four sisters. Then you can even put on there which nun you want to ask. That'll be good fun. Ha ha ha. And you're the senior nun, Ben Melissa, aren't you? Yeah, so you can always delegate. You pass it down. I hereby delegate this nun to answer. So, but you have to come. You can't be absent tomorrow. You can't stay in your room. So you have to come. Anyway. Dear Ajahn, can you explain about the three types of conceit? Thank you. The three types of conceit, it's a very nice part of thinking. I am the best, better than other people, or I am worse than other people. That's also conceit. That's one of my favorite ones, because I always thought that, you know, if you think you're worse than other people, that's not conceit, but that's conceit again. I am better, I am worse, and the last type of conceit, I am the same. It's all measuring. You can't measure you. You're not the same. You're not better. You're not sort of the worst. You're just different, that's all. So that's wonderful. We don't measure ourselves against others. No best, no worse, no the same. The three conceits. So, you know, that's what I said. That's how an arahat expresses themselves to the Buddha. They say one who's enlightened doesn't never thinks they're better than anybody else, never thinks they're worse than anybody else, never thinks they're the same. They don't even think like that. So, no self. There's nothing. So how can my nothing be better than your nothing, or the same as your nothing, or worse than your nothing? It's just nothing, that's all. Dear Ajahn, what are the timescales Buddha was talking about between appearances of different Buddhas? The time scales. We go beyond time. Because what is time anyway? Is time is a creation of desire. When you stop wanting stuff, time vanishes. You're just here. Wanting creates a place where your wanting can manifest, otherwise called the future. Wanting to get rid of stuff in the past creates the past. So when you don't want anything, you're not creating the future. You're not creating the past. You're free of time. Which is why people have the great experiences. They're meditating here. They're so still and so peaceful. And hours go past and you don't notice it. It's just, wow, that was really interesting. That was only like 5 minutes and 2 hours have gone past. And you've been perfectly alert, haven't been asleep, because you've been content and not wanting anything. So desire is what creates time. Da, da, da. Anyway, dear Ajahn, the question for two nuns. Oh no, this is tomorrow. Okay, this is for tomorrow's question. You've got your first question for tomorrow. Dear Ajahn, when I was watching my breath, after some time it disappeared. Great. For a while nothing happened after that. Great. Nothing. Emptiness. That's what's supposed to happen. Later, a light appeared. Okay. It was on and off at first, then stayed, but flickered. Then it was stable. After a while, the light started to move towards me, and it stopped just above my forehead. Off the screen, but I knew it was there, and I could still see the light emitting, and another light appeared to the top right corner, but it was also off the screen. This kept going on for some time, And my leg started to hurt, so I had to come out of meditation. There's always a but here. If this happens again in the future, what should I do? Absolutely nothing. Cut your legs off. Sit on a chair. Better get really good, and then last leg started to hurt. Take a morphine or something. I don't know. No, I shouldn't say things like that. Never mind, you've got clothes. So lights come along, which is great. And it doesn't matter where they are. Sometimes they are over here somewhere. They're just testing you out to see whether you're ready yet to be with the Nimitta. And if you if you want them, then they won't come into the center. If you just leave them, oh, you can be there. I'm just happy being peaceful. And then they will center. And if they really center and you start enjoying the meditation, then you don't worry about your legs. That happened to me many times when I was watching movies as a kid or watching the soccer. Oh, you know, you'd be watching that, and only after the soccer would finish, you'd go, oh, my legs hurt. Oh, I need to go to the toilet. Oh, I need something. But while you're actually really into watching the game or watching a movie, you don't even feel your legs. They may even go to sleep, and you wouldn't notice it. Simply because your focus is on something enjoyable. So if that's a soccer match or a football or a movie, imagine how more delightful it is when the Nimittas come up. And then they get so beautiful you can't feel the body anymore. And so your legs can do whatever they like. And the weird thing is that you think, oh, you know, after 45 minutes my legs always hurt. So imagine meditating for 2 hours or 3 hours or 4 hours. Oh, that's going to hurt when I come back to my body. My legs, my knees haven't moved for all that time. This is going to be real suffering. But it's not. After 45 minutes, if you don't get into deep meditation, yeah, your legs might hurt. But after 4 hours, they don't hurt at all. So that's one of the weird things about deep meditation. Once you come out, if you're sitting for hours, you think, oh, this is going to hurt. But it doesn't. Your body is just so pain-free. So light, so easy, so you don't have to worry. The longer you sit, the less it hurts, as long as you get into deep meditation. Can you share with us some of your stories about meditating in the cave? How long are you there for? Do you eat? And how do you overcome your challenges? Of course I eat. And have your challenges, no challenges, but I tell, because Nimittas are very strange. This is one of my stories. I told all the monks about this, and I told people at a retreat in London about this. Nimittas can take many, many different forms. And 2 or 3 years ago, I got one of the strangest Nimittas. It was a Nimitta because the colors were really incredibly bright and just yellows like you never see in the real world, getting really, really peaceful and calm. In the cave, opposite the road, during the rains retreat, really peaceful, beautiful Nimittas, and a big Nimitta came up, very bright, very brilliant, but it was an image of somebody I knew very well. It was an image of Garfield the cat in the cartoon series. I've never had a stupid Nimitta like that, even though it was very brilliant. It was a Nimitta, it was very clear, you know, yellows deep in that. And I just burst out laughing. That was the end of that meditation. That actually takes a lot to get the Garfield Nimitta. That's a very rare Nimitta to get. You know, just like in the cartoons, look exactly like that. Because when I get the newspapers, that's the first thing I look for in the cartoons. They're actually useful. Everything else is just a lot of old rubbish. But anyway, so that's one thing happened in the cave. That's probably enough. How to overcome thoughts of spiritual fantasy. No spiritual fantasy. I know what spiritual fantasy that is. Like getting Garfield the cat Nimittas or flying through the air. Because every now and again when I have dreams, I tell the monks, I just had one the other, what was it, about 2 or 3 weeks ago. And it was like psychic powers. My dreams are always psychic powers and I'm always, I don't know why this is, always competing against Hindu saints. Flying through the air, sapping each other. But of course, because it's my dream, I always win. That's my dream. That was really crazy, but good, great fun. So I don't know what spiritual fantasy you really have. Spiritual fantasy is much better than, you know, the other sexual fantasies or money fantasies, at least, you know, spiritual fantasies. And I said that this morning, that it's almost like a spiritual fantasy just to sit down and just pretend you were the Buddha. And that's actually very skillful. I hope you've tried that after I mentioned it. Sit down, close your eyes, get yourselves comfortable, imagine what it must be like being a Buddha, meditating like a Buddha. And if you do that, it's very powerful. Get Ajahn, not a question. If it's not a question, I won't answer it. Question times. Dear Ajahn Brahmwangsa, why? What? Answer is nothing. I told you that this morning. You have a question here, what or why? And the answer is nothing. I suppose I should do this out of respect. What does it say? If you can read the questions and give the answers slowly, it would benefit many. Or we could start Q&A at 7:30 to 9 p.m, then you are not pressured. Or give each room identified stamped piece of paper, 6 each, so that they are limited to ask 6 questions during the retreat. Anything else they can ask you personally at interviews. That's interesting, but it's not that I'm talking too fast. It's you're listening too slow. It's not the noise disturbs you, it's you disturb the noise, okay? I do not agree with the comment you made this morning, about weight being the only thing one gains on this retreat. Whilst I have certainly gained plenty of weight, I'm proud to say that I've also gained calmness, peace of mind, compassion, mindfulness, and some insight. This, of course, in addition to letting go of other things. And thanks to your wisdom and teachings. You don't gain calmness, you let go of noise. That's a very powerful teaching. You don't gain things on this retreat. It looks like you've changed, but really what's happened, you've lost stuff. So don't try and gain calm, don't try and gain compassion. Let go of its opposites. Because this is like peace of mind, compassion, mindfulness, insight. That's like a default state. When everything else vanishes, that's what's left. So you don't gain wisdom. You let go of stupidity. Dear Ajahn, please tell us a bit about the beginnings of the nuns' monastery. Where did you find the bhikkhunis? Oh, they were on eBay. You just type in B for bhikkhunis. No, it wasn't eBay, it was Enbay, Nunbay. Who came up with the idea? Who was against it? Thank you so much for supporting the nuns. The nuns' monastery. That was a long time ago. That we had our monks. It was really hard to start monasteries. My first year was just really, really hard work. It was only Ajahn Jaco and I, and sometimes we didn't get fed. You know, we're strict monks. So it happened quite a few times the first months. We'd be in a small house in North Perth, and had a look once. I asked the treasurer, so how are we going? And we had a debt for the house, a mortgage of $49,000, and it was worth $50,000. We had 1,000 equity, nothing in the bank. So really, really starting out, just really with nothing. And then also that sometimes people are too busy to come and offer the food. So they put it in there the night before, put it in the fridge. It's only 2 months, not that much. We'd wait for someone to offer it. And we'd wait. And we'd wait. 10 o'clock. 10:30. 11:30. 11:45. They forgot to come. We could see the food. We could smell it. But we couldn't touch it. Aww. That was really thin in those days. Sometimes you see photographs of me then, you can't recognize this as the same monk. It is. So eventually we got support. Honestly, one of the reasons was that people didn't trust us. They didn't know who we were. Just a couple of Western monks, you know, coming from Thailand. Who are these guys? Are they real? And of course, why should you support something If it's just a couple of months come and they just go in another 6 months. So after a while, you know, we had to build up the trust of the lay supporters. And for them to realize we were in here for the long term. We're not just coming and just going to go after a year if it doesn't work. We hang in there. And so because we stayed a long time, you know, there's a sense of you could rely on us. And so that's when more people started to come. And look, I've been here now for 33 years. So I'm a known quantity. So, you know, you check me out many times. You know, I'm not a bad monk. And so because of that, you trust. And that's why it's just so easy to start new projects. Because, say, on Ajahn Brahm, you know, doesn't sort of take the money and just put it in his own bank account. I haven't got a slush fund somewhere. And so because of that trust, which has come up with all the monks and nuns over the years, it's so easy for people actually to give donations because you trust it's going to be used properly. And so we got some land for Bodhinyana Monastery. And again, we couldn't afford it. I just remember that we had 3 months to pay off the loans. And it was about 2 days before we finally got a check, which was just over the top. You know, 9 months, 3 months we had to raise the money, and we only just made it by 2 days, which was cutting it fine. So we could get Bodhinyana Monastery. And you all know the stories there. There was no buildings there at all. And my first place where actually the first place I got lost, I stepped under a tree the first night. And it's not to be recommended. It's cold at night time. But then I went to the next stage up. We got 2 doors from the salvage yard. And with Ajahn Chakra and I, we put them on, 2 or 3 bricks on each corner to raise them off the ground. And that's what we slept on. Because I was a junior monk, Ajahn Chakra got the best door, the flat one. Now, mine was one of these ornate doors with ribbing on it. And I don't know why, but the doorknob used to go in the middle, so there's a big hole in the middle of the door. But that was quite a positive, because then I could, I didn't need to get out of bed to go to the toilet. If you can imagine that. And we were hardly slept at night. It's just so cold. And we'd only go Monday to Friday. And Friday evening we went to North Perth, to an evening talk. And I really looked forward to that. You know, a hot shower. And then, sleep, catch up on your sleep, because you weren't sleeping hardly at all over there. So it was really tough. But we were tough monks. And I keep telling that to the young monks. When I was a young monk, and oh God, not again. But it was true, it was like that. Really tough. So, but because we were tough, and whenever funds came, we worked really hard. You see me working. I was a stupid monk. Some of the stuff which I did, I was absolutely crazy. You know, the main hall you see in Bodhinyana, you know who the builder of that was? Brahma Wangso. I got my name on the building license. I was a builder there. And so, if you can imagine that building without any roof on, without any rafters on, just the brickwork, and there was a few bricks I needed to put up on the very, very top, on the apex. So what did I do? You know, because, the brickwork is, it's almost like steps. So I had a bucket of mortar in one hand, with the trowel in, bricks in the other hand, and I just walked up right to the very top. No ladders, no nothing. I was absolutely daft, crazy. How I didn't fall off, I don't know. And I just went to the top just to lay a few bricks on the top. And it's very unstable. You have to be very careful. But, if you saw me do that, occupational health and safety would put me in jail for doing stuff like that. But anyway, you had a lot of faith and sort of you got everything done eventually. So we built the monastery. And it hasn't changed that much. It's not ornate. And this is one of the big things. If you do build any monasteries or any temples, don't build ornate ones. You're wasting money on gold and pictures and stuff. So keep it simple, because that's our tradition. And that means that people got confidence in you, that you're not wasting money. You know, you're trying to build yourself so you don't waste stuff. And so once we did that, then the next thing was actually was Nuns Monastery. So that was a tough thing because I didn't know whether people would support it. But I just asked people, are you interested in this? And they said, yeah. And everybody thought this was, you know, a fair thing to do. Obviously, you have a place for monks, let's have a place for women as well. So that was, I love telling this story. That's probably, you all know, that's why you want me to tell it again. But looking for land. Oh, first of all, you know, not much money until this guy came along. I think I told you the story earlier. Guy came along, never seen him before in my life, never seen him again since. And he said that he said he was a Buddhist. His wife had just given birth to his first child, happened to be a daughter, and he wanted to do something in honour to celebrate the birth of his first child. He said, I hear you're collecting money for a nuns monastery. I want to give a donation to the nuns monastery project. We haven't built anything yet, which is an idea and a bank account with a couple of $1,000 in it, not much. I want to give a donation so that if my daughter ever wants to become a Buddhist nun, she can. She will have that choice. She probably won't, but who knows? And then he handed over a check for $250,000. And I'd never seen so much money before. This guy, just, I don't know who he was, but $250,000 Aussie dollars, just like that. And then he vanished, never seen him. I don't even know his name. That's weird. So sometimes I think, you know, looking back upon that, was it a deva? Weird. But anyway, that's how the Nuns Monastery got started. And so, then we got some nuns. We had to get the place first of all. And so we're looking around for land. And it was actually Bianca and a former partner who passed away, Ron. We're driving me around here, driving me around there, trying to find some land. And there was some land up in Gitigan of 30 acres. And he took me to see this 30 acres. And quite frankly, that's not enough for a monastery. And that's just, to me, that was actually just disrespectful. You know, to think that sort of women can get a smaller monastery and just, you know, fit them into just this tiny little piece of land. But on the way, we saw this big sign, sort of 563 acres or 83 acres of solitude. And as soon as I saw that, let's go and have a look. And I said, no, we'd never be able to afford that. I said, well, it doesn't cost anything to have a look. So on the way back, you can ask Bianca this. You know, she will confirm this. I insisted. I put my foot down, used my power and said, stop, I want to have a look. We went, it's absolutely perfect. And that was the Nuns Monastery. We said, no, we'd never be able to afford this. But who knows, give it a try. It was on auction. And so we went to the auction site. You know, we talked about it and people loved it. And, you know, borrowing a bit of money here, borrowing a bit of money there. Maximum, you know, and this was stretching our ability to actually repay all these loans, was $600,000. And we agreed, no committee, say, look, that's maximum we can actually go. If it's any more than that, we just have to say bad luck. So, I went there with the other monks. Remember Ajahn Chittamala? I went there with him early, an hour early before the auction. And we did some really heavy chanting. Really powerful stuff. To try and get the local beings on side. And then we had the auction. And the treasurer, that was Rodney George. But the one doing the auctioning, I'll never forget this guy, Eddie Fernando. Because he's a real estate agent. And we told him, 600,000 max, okay. And the auction started. And if you've ever been to an auction, they start off, you know, very slowly and say, this is a beautiful piece of land. And then they start to raise their voice. And who's going to bid? 200,000. Do I hear 225? 225? Do I hear 250? 250? 275? Do what? They really wind you up, get you all excited, so you say things you shouldn't. But, you know, we were calm, good Buddhists. And he got to $25,000 jumps. So it got to 575. And Eddie put his hand up. 600,000, yes. And I was using all my powers to keep everyone's mouth shut. May no one be able to speak. And then this person put his hand up, 625. Oh, my heart sank. And then Eddie put his hand up again, 650! Oh. Totally against committee rules. Treasurer was going ballistic sitting next to me. Can't say that! Take it back! But he said it already. And of course, I said, have some faith, Eddie. We can't afford it. Who cares? So, it passed at 650. We got it. And I always remember going to Nottingham. That was, I forget when the auction was, the next day, making the announcement. And everybody cheered at Nolamara Temple. There, we got it. We found the extra $50,000 somewhere, and so we were off, started. But of course, now that was how many years ago now? A long time ago now. And you know, it was good old Ajahn Wayama, really tried her best, but you know, got sick there, so always remember her, her sacrifice, getting it started, and then the other nuns are now taking it to the stage now. So that's actually how it started. And a huge amount of work and sacrifice. Ajahn Wayama, for 1 year, she stayed in a tiny caravan. And it was really boiling hot. She really enjoyed a lot that first year. So, you know, good on her to get it started. So this is actually how you start monasteries off. And after that, we built this place. And just to let you know, if you don't know, my next project is, I just came back from London, a nun's project. A nun's monastery, Bikuni Monastery in UK. And that land is so expensive over there. I've got NBM as well. I'm still looking after that monastery too. So expensive over in London. But I went over there and somebody transferred 400,000 Great British Pounds. That's like the 250. That's just kickstarts it, gets it started. And people are really amazing. I mean, who's got £400,000 to actually just to give to a project? There are some heavenly beings out there somewhere. And when you do an inspiring project, it happens. That's why I really enjoy this life. You get these stupid ideas, and actually some of them actually work. Weird. Anyway, that's actually... Who came up with the idea? Well, who's against it? Who was against nuns? Actually, most people weren't, but the ordinations, a few people are against the ordination of nuns, but they're not now. Dear Ajahn, what is Yathabhuta Jhana knowledge? This is what happens as a result of jhanas. You see things as they truly are. In other words, you understand what water is. You're a frog now, not a tadpole. And so much stuff which you never knew is now clear to you. You have the data to see that what you assumed it was not the truth. Anyway, you'll soon find out what that is. You were talking last night about praise. Is there the risk with praise that it can simply build up the person's ego? It actually, praise doesn't usually build a person's ego. You don't get a big head, you get actually a big heart if you receive praise. It gives you confidence, it gives you much more ability. Usually people with big egos are people who don't receive enough praise, and so they just make out that they're good. They're not really sort of receive much praise in their life. Big egos, it's the response to actually not receiving praise. And I'm pretty sure that if you do praise people in this world and build them up and let them see their good qualities and emphasize their good qualities, they won't become big egos, but they'll be confident people who have much greater abilities in life to do what they need to do. And they won't need to have the big egos. They'll just be kind, good people. Have you had any psychic battles with anyone? I told my dreams with Hindus. Fly through the air, zap, zap, zap. That was really good fun, that. So, psychic battles with anyone. When monks and nuns have disagreements, do they travel up into the astral plane and battle it all out? Wow, you know how we do this stuff now. Sure, you'll save the BSW a lot of money on fuel and air ticket if you taught all your monks and nuns to fly. I've often thought about that. Instead of flying Qantas or Singapore Airlines, what happens if we just actually flew there? Now, of course, what would happen? As soon as they checked your ticket on arrival, you say, I've got no ticket. And you say, I flew here. Now, what would the immigration and customs do with you then? In fact, you do not have a place on the form. All they have is the name of your flight or the ship or the car registration number. Imagine as you say that I levitated here and you arrived in the United States saying that. I'm sure you know what would happen next. Straight to Guantanamo Bay. So, because of that, we don't do such stuff. And even if we did, what would happen if we had psychic powers and we showed them to people? First of all, you know, that would, you know, that's the pride stuff, because you show yourself to be different than others, and that creates a segregation in the Sangha. So if we do have psychic powers, we don't show them. And if we did have those psychic powers, suppose it was really clear that I could read people's minds. What would happen to the monks and nuns who could read people's minds? Straight away, they would take you, maybe here in Perth, you'd just be at the immigration. You know, you wouldn't need to scan people's luggage when they come in. You could see straight away, oh yes, he's got marijuana, he's got food in his bag, I can read your minds. It'd be much better than sort of, you know, having... And terrorists, you know exactly who's a terrorist on board. Just like the story here, come a nice joke. There was a man on the aircraft, and he couldn't believe, he's on a window seat, and the man in next to him in the middle seat, and there's a dog on the aisle seat. He said, what's a dog doing on an aircraft? And the guy in the middle seat said, well, I'm its handler, this is security. Modern security for aircraft. Look, I'll show you how it works, he said. And he sent the dog, you know, down the aisles in economy. And the dog came back, wagged its tail and barked once after he smelt this young backpacker. And the handler said, oh, one bark wagging its tail is a signal that backpacker is carrying marijuana. When we get to the other end, I'll alert the customs, we'll arrest him. That's a sign that the dog has smelt marijuana on the plane. Let's see what's in business class. I went into business class, he smelt this well-dressed woman, came back, wagged his tail, and barked twice. Wow, that's cocaine. She's got cocaine in her. So, you know, we'll arrest her when we get to the other end. Let's see what's up in first class. So I went up to first class, there was a really, really well-dressed guy, and the dog sniffed him, barked three times, wagging its tail. Well, that's heroin. Three barks means heroin. Let's see what else is on this plane. And then he went back to economy class and smelt, as his total stereotyping, smelt this guy in a turban, came back, and this time he didn't bark at all. He put his tail between his legs, whined, and pooed on the seat. He said, what's that a sign of? Oh, that guy's carrying a bomb. That's what a dog would do. He knows he's going to die as well. Okay, how'd they get into that one? Okay, yeah. Okay, that's a stupid question, so that's a stupid answer. One who enjoys sensual pleasures and also has undiminished greed, hatred, and ill will can attain jhanas. Do they coexist? Thank you. It's almost impossible if you have just so much greed and sensory pleasures and ill will to get into jhanas, because those people are control freaks, number one. And they always think that they can get what they want by, you know, using their willpower and other means. And jhana is not sort of a result of willpower. It's a result of the total opposite, being able to let go of stuff. That's why such people are almost impossible to get even close to meditation. And, you know, they try sometimes, they just can't not do stuff. I want to do a range retreat in the next few years. Is there a long waiting list? Oh, if you put all the people trying to get into the range retreat in a line, it will stretch all the way from here to Colombo in Sri Lanka. Oh, that's a bit of exaggeration. But yeah, there's always a waiting list. But if you're really smart and you really want to do it, there's always a way. Dear Ajahn Brahm, which BSW fund is most in need of donations? All of them. No, wherever your heart really wishes to give a donation. Usually what I say, if you're in a nun's monastery, give it to the nun's monastery. If you're in the monk's monastery, give it to the monk's monastery. If you're in Nolamara, give it to Nolamara. If you're here, give it to here. You know, you're benefiting from this place, so this is where you should go. Wow. I don't think I can answer that question. That's got me beat. Wow, what a great question. It's blank. That question has totally discombobulated me. That's one of my favourite words. To discombobulate means to actually confuse. Dear Ajahn Brahm, you mentioned on day one that some places have better energy and are therefore more conducive to meditation. Can you please elaborate? Can we make an energised place for meditation at home? Yeah, you can. One of the ways to do that is you find one place in your house which you only use for meditation and nothing else. It can be under the stairs. It can be in a cupboard. It can be a corner of your bedroom. But you don't do anything else there. And after a while, it builds up energy. And what some people do, we did this actually to raise funds for the nuns and monastery, they take a cushion which I've been sitting on and we auction it. I already mentioned that one of my cushions, I've been sitting on that for years, went for $30,000. $30,000! So a lot of money for a meditation cushion. Because they want to put it in their house to get really good energy. Fair enough. But now, in my cave, my real meditation cushion I have to lock up in the safe. Well, I don't do that. But yeah, sometimes it's true. If you sit in places, you know, where the Buddha sat, that's got huge energy. So you build up the energy yourself by only meditating there, nothing else. And only do meditation there. You can get some guided meditations on a tape, books, get a nice Buddha statue or some photos, which gives it energy, gives it atmosphere. And after a while that becomes your little shrine. And it does build up energy after a while. Hopefully you've been over to the Bodhinyana Monastery Hall, especially the front, great energy there. And I like telling the story that somebody, without my knowledge, they brought their Feng Shui master over. He's supposed to be a very famous Feng Shui master, and took him into the hall. And that master said straight away, wow, the Feng Shui in the front of this hall is huge, in the back not so much. But you know, he was actually a real proper Feng Shui master. And he could actually feel the energy. Without being told it's a special place, he really got it straight away. Next, when the nimitta appears, either get too excited, usually at the start when it first shows up, or afraid, as it gets more intense and brighter, if I somehow manage to luckily bypass the excitement. Either way, it always gets back to square one again. What to do? And it's actually, it's called Upakalesa Sutta. There the Buddha, he spends a whole sutta describing what to do with nimittas and what happens when the nimittas, you know, either mostly fear or excitement, not enough energy, too much energy, and how to actually to balance them. It's an important part of meditation. But it's excitement and fear are the two main ones. Remember that both of those can be overcome. Just the slow way is just by becoming, recognizing them, becoming familiar with them, and then you become at ease with them. Those three levels. Recognition, familiarity, and ease. Which happens with everything. After a while, you understand what they are, you understand how they work, so you don't get excited, you don't get afraid, you just let them be. Which means you relax in their presence and they stay with you. The other way, which I mentioned this morning, is programming your mindfulness. If they usually come at your meditation, you say, when the nimitta comes, I will not get excited, I will not get excited, I will not get excited. Program your mindfulness, and then when the nimitta comes, amazingly, the old habit, because it's habits of excitement, just doesn't arise. If you overcome excitement, then the fear also. You say, oh, when the inevitable comes up, I will not be afraid, I'll not be afraid, I'll not be afraid. Repeating that to yourself 3 times in your own words, your own language, and then that actually works. And that means that you go past excitement, you go past fear, and you can really enjoy the bliss and the beauty of the nematis. Okay. This one, I'll read later on. So that's actually how those ones work, but please know that that's very common to have those problems. To the person who was asking about Ajahn Sujato, Ajahn Sujato will be giving teachers in Sydney again at some point, maybe even possibly next year. If so, he'll be advertised in his blog. Also, there are some other good Dhamma teachers in Sydney who travel to Sydney sometimes. I hope that helps. Yeah, there's many people, actually, good meditators and teachers go to Sydney. But Ajahn Sujato, if you know him, he's took the time off to do some translation. I think he's almost finished now, so he should be coming back soon. This afternoon I was seated on the stupa, quietly reflecting. And then I saw this vision appearing. It was a brown, round object. Brown and round? Are you talking about me again? Descending slowly. Was this a nimitta? Then it became bigger and clearer. It was Ajahn Brahm. Your Holiness, holding onto your robes as a parachute and descending across the skies. Sadly, the image disappeared before I could witness the landing. Or get out your camera. No, that wasn't me. I deny it. Okay. Thank you for postponing your liberation until our generation. This samsara journey. We are so fortunate to have you as our teacher, hoping that most of us will reach out of Gomaya. Postponing my liberation? No way. I'm out of here. You can come along with me if you want, but if you don't... A very bright light, like a shining diamond, and other bright white thing like a cloud appeared from a distance and came towards me. Both disappeared very quickly. I got goosebumps. Is this nimitta? I don't know if you had your eyes closed, but if you had your eyes closed, that would have been nimitta, bright light and another bright white shining thing. But sometimes, you know, that people see that, you know, at night time, bright lights in the forest. And those are dark devas sometimes. And people actually see those things. And because there's lots of good people here, these are the sort of places devas would come to. But you don't need to be afraid, because they're always incredible, beautiful stuff. You don't get any ghosts here, or bad spirits, because, as I mentioned to you, that bad spirits can't come close when there's good people here. We've got like force fields around us. This was a story which was told to me by this Thai lady. Her mother was in Thailand, and she didn't have anyone to look after her. So this Thai girl invited her mother to come and stay with her in Perth. And those were the days you could actually get visas, family visas, you know, reasonably easily. So her elderly mother came to Perth and lived with this Thai woman. Thai woman had kids, but no husband. And soon her elderly mother got sick, went into King Edward Memorial Hospital. That's right, King Edward, yeah. And the Thai girl was wondering whether her mother would survive the illness. And so she went to a medium in Perth. And the medium charged her $20, that's all. She was actually quite a good medium. And she said, I can find out whether your mother is going to survive the illness or not. All I will need, other than the $20, is the hospital, the ward and the room number. And I'd leave my body and just go and check her out. And so I gave the $20, and then this medium went unconscious in a trance. And about 10 or 15 minutes later, she came out of the trance, opened her eyes, and the first thing she did was to give the $20 back. And the Thai woman said, well, what are you doing that for? Couldn't you find my mum? She said, yeah, I found her, okay. I found the hospital, the ward, the room. But I couldn't get in the door. There was this huge force field around your mother. I've never seen this before. You know, who is your mother? Who is she? And the Thai girl said, She has been a Buddhist nun for the last 30 years. At which point the medium snatched the 20 bucks back and said, you should have told me beforehand. You wasted my time. People like me can't get close to people like that. And that was, you know, one of the many stories of what happens if you're a really good person. So spirits, devas maybe, but not bad spirits, they can't even get close to you. You have like, what they see is like a force field around you. And they just can't penetrate it. So that's what it's really like with spirits. Dear Ajahn, when meditating, my breath becomes very subtle and becomes unnoticeable. Then I start to notice my heartbeat, and this keeps going on. It's very good your heartbeat keeps going on. Don't stop it, please. Is it okay to notice a heartbeat after breath stops, or is it a barrier to go into deeper meditation? It is a barrier to go into deeper meditation, because the whole idea of meditation is things get slower and slower, and then they disappear. And if your heartbeat stops and disappears, then you are in big trouble. So what we usually do in that case is, number one, don't pay too much attention to the heartbeat. And if the heartbeat comes up, use the simile of the screen. Put the heartbeat on the edge of the screen. Never center on the heartbeat. Keep the breath after the breath disappears. There's always something left there after the breath disappears. But don't center on the heartbeat. Leave that on the edge. And then eventually, because it's on the edge, you're focusing on something else. The heartbeat just vanishes by itself. It's still going on, but you're paying no attention to it. Otherwise, it gets very, very disturbing. So it's not a good object to notice your heartbeat. Well, I'm going through them very quickly tonight. Dear Ajahn, what is the Buddhist interpretation of a parallel universe? In case there is a parallel universe, shouldn't there be a religion similar to Buddhism exist within, with another Buddha in a parallel universe? Another Ajahn Brahm, another nun's monastery in a parallel universe. A parallel universe is just one interpretation of quantum physics. I prefer the other interpretation of quantum physics, the Copenhagen interpretation, which to me makes things much less weird. So, one universe is enough. A parallel universe is that because there's equal probabilities of two things happening, so the only way that one way they can understand that is just there's two universes created, and it's always bifurcating, dividing every moment. So there's millions, billions, zillions of parallel universes, but that doesn't make any sense to me. But what does make sense, even in this universe, is so many solar systems, so many galaxies. The last time I heard it was 10 to the 11th hundred thousand million galaxies in this universe. I think somebody said they found a few more since then. So 100,000 million, give 100,000 million here and there. That's a lot of galaxies. These are galaxies, and every galaxy is roughly about 100,000 million stars. And every star has, well, not every star, but many stars have planets. Surely the odds are that some of those planets have beings, sentient beings on them, aliens. And I know that aliens exist. I have proof. Because when I went to England recently, when I arrived at Heathrow Airport, I saw with my own eyes, there was a sign, UK citizens, EU residents, and aliens. They have their own counter to check in. So that's proof, there are such things as aliens. But if there really were aliens, would you be able to see them? Remember the story I said about the flower pot rising? It was so weird, so unacceptable, that many of those professors, they just denied it actually happened. So are there aliens sitting among us right now? But I like, you know, Calvin and Hobbes. He gave the best philosophical answer to the likelihood of aliens. he said, it's quite obvious that aliens exist. That there is intelligent life in the universe. And it's because it's intelligent, that's why they've never visited us. You'd have to be stupid to come and visit this place. So anyway, next question. If the worm monk did not want to be pulled out of the shithole, was it his karma? What options did he have? Oh, you can always have the option just to let go and allow yourself to be pulled out and see what happens. Have a bit of adventure and a lack of fear of the unknown. Because sometimes in meditation, you have to be quite courageous and willing to just see things you've never seen before. Don't always stay in your comfort zone. Do things a bit different. That's why I love in these retreats, you know, doing three sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. No other monk in the whole world does that. You know, you innovate, do it a bit different every time. Because with that innovation, that's a sign of like you're courageous, willing to actually to explore. As they used to say in Star Trek, remember anyone used to watch Star Trek? Apparently it's still going. In Star Trek, they'd always say their mission, to boldly go, where no man has gone before. That's my job as a monk, to boldly go, where no man has gone before. And actually to, you know, to see new stuff. So sometimes I've always been sort of very adventurous in that respect. And because you're adventurous in that respect, you can go to Thailand. And just, you know, try it out in these forest monasteries. That was really weird, going to those places. And just going into deep caves, see what was there. And also into deep meditation. It takes a bit of courage to let go of everything you were familiar with and see something totally different. So that's why a lot of times people just, you know, not courageous enough, something like a really big nimitta arises, and no, not for me. No, I don't want that. I'm going to stay in my shit instead of allowing yourself to be drawn out of it. So it does need a sense of adventure and courage. But also I can help there by just, and other monks and nuns who experience these things, by talking about them a lot. And yes, sometimes you talk about them a lot, you can actually generate a lot of desire and wanting, which is counterproductive. But at the same time, by talking about these things, it takes away a lot of the fear. Because, you know, a nimitta comes up, now you know exactly what it is. I keep on saying it's very, very safe, and, you know, you have trust in me. So it is very safe, which means that, you know, you don't get so afraid. There's still a bit of fear there, but, you know, oh, yeah, and we've been taught what this is. It's par for the course, you're not going crazy, it's safe. So there's a more of a chance that you will actually just let go enough to allow that nimitta to develop, really develop, and also in the end just take over. You know, there was on one of the retreats, you know, I was always telling the story of like being a passenger, letting go of the steering wheel, letting go of the pedals, and just allowing the meditation just to take you. And this woman came along with one of the interviews and said she had this really great dream the night before, that she was driving in a car with me in the passenger seat, heading for a cliff. And because I was in the passenger seat, I said, don't worry, it's okay. And she was terrified, and I said, okay, now's the time, take your hands off the steering wheel, feet off the pedals. And in her dream, she did. We went over the cliff together. And over the cliff, really just vertically down, really top speed, and she saw at the bottom of the cliff, there was a road, but on that road had a really, really sharp right turn. And she went to, you know, get hold of the steering wheel. I said, no! Keep your hands off the steering wheel, feet off the pedals. So we were careering down the cliff to imminent, certain death. And when we actually got to the bottom, the car turned a perfect right turn all by itself. And then we're going at normal speed along the road at the bottom of the cliff. It worked. And when she told me that, I said, of course. But that gave her a lot of confidence. At least in her dream, you know, she could let go enough, you know, just to allow the whole vehicle, you know, just to do what it needed to do. And that's such a great simile for meditation, because that's what happens. Sometimes you think it's totally out of control, you're going to explode, you're going to burst, you know, no one can take so much bliss, this is really weird, oh, not me. Have that bit of confidence, let go of the steering wheel, feet off the pedal, and you're totally safe. And you just career into these beautiful meditations. So it's because I say that, that you can actually overcome some of the fear. She managed to do that in her dream, so the next thing to do is to do it in her meditation. And that means that she'll get some really, really great states. So you do have to have that bit of adventure and courage. And afterwards you find it's totally safe. And in fact, it's the best thing you possibly ever did. But if you do come across fear, you can always feel reassured, it's par for the course. Even the Buddha said he was afraid at first doing those deep meditations. And afterwards he said many, many times to the monks, to the nuns, and now to you, do not be afraid of that powerful pleasure. Don't be afraid of it. Because it leads to the most wonderful states of mind, to enlightenment. But you have to have some courage. We always people who push the boundaries of knowledge and experience, the explorers, both the physical explorers who go to new lands, who go into space, or the people who explore new ideas in science, in philosophy. These are always very courageous, because a lot of times when you first invent something new or see something new, people think you're stupid. They always laugh at you, first of all. And all of the great inventions, they all started off, people thought they were stupid. No way can it be that way. And that's one of the reasons why I love this quote. Because I saw this on the wall, graffiti on the wall of the Cavendish Laboratory in Cambridge when I was a student there. And I always remember this little saying, the eminence of a great scientist. His eminence, his fame, his power, is measured by the length of time he stops progress in his field. The more sort of eminent they are, the more they stop new ideas coming up. So actually to be someone who gets new ideas in science or gets into the deep meditations, you have to be a bit courageous and a bit of a rebel. To say, no, I'm not going to just do the ordinary stuff. I'm going to see what's on the other side of these limiters. I'm going to let them take me in and see what happens. And that way you see things that no one else has ever saw. That's why even the Buddha was a rebel. His first five disciples abandoned him. They thought, no, that's not the way to get enlightened, what you're doing. And they abandoned him. And only later on they thought, wow, you know, there's something different about you. You have got something. And so he could teach them this new way, which was counterintuitive. Being kind to yourself. People always thought the only way to get somewhere in spiritual life was being an ascetic, being really austere, and whipping yourself, or, you know, fasting, and doing all these really tough practices. No pain, no gain. And the Buddha said, no way. There's another way, the middle way. And that was incredibly rebellious and unique in that particular time. So you also have to, you know, not just follow what you've been taught. Go way beyond that. See it for yourself. And just have that courage to let go of the steering wheel. Feed off the pedals and see what happens. Ajahn Chah would always encourage you to do that. He was always willing to do anything for you if you were just meditating and being courageous and seeing what happens next. So, that is the last question tonight. Maybe I answered didn't answer the first ones maybe in detail enough. But anyway, that's good enough. So, that is the Q&A for tonight. And for tomorrow, we have the special Q&A with the nuns. So please ask them lots of difficult questions. Now be kind to them and see what happens. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, so have a wonderful night. Those who've still got some energy, nice thing to meditate. And I'll leave this one question for the nuns in the basket for tomorrow. So have a good night. Early night for some of you.